So I'm very good at compartmentalizing. And my dad was Puerto Rican, but I was not. Okay. So I hid all of that. My dad was super proud of it. And for the first time, I watched what happened to George Floyd, and I put my dad in that position. And I was like, so for me now, all of a sudden, it became personal. And that's what changed. When I was able to take an event and make it personal for myself, I couldn't hide anymore.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Multiracial White Boy. I'm your host, Kim Noonan. I'm a mixed transracial adoptee from Vietnam, and this is my podcast where I examine the impact of my white upbringing by having personal discussions with other mixed individuals about racial identity. That small audio clip you just heard is from my guest today, Tori Sorge. I follow Tori on Instagram. And one day she posted something that I found interesting. It read, "Having a white parent doesn't somehow dilute your mixed identity." Again, having a white parent doesn't somehow dilute your mixed identity. I don't know much about Tori, but I became curious about her because, like myself, she grew up with the white family and community too. And, you know, I reached out to her because I wanted to discuss this topic. Does having white parents dilute your mixed identity? Now, before we go into, you know, our discussion, me and Tori's discussion, a little bit about her. Tori grew up with her single white mother in Ohio. However, she did not grow up with her biological father, who was black and Puerto Rican. In fact, she didn't meet him until she was a senior in high school. And, you know, I saw her on Instagram, but what I didn't realize was that Tori spent a great deal of her life trying to hide that she was half black and Puerto Rican, basically. In fact, she admits during our conversation that she was mastering the art of passing while living as a biracial mixed kid in Ohio. And I related to this all too well, wanting to erase my ethnic heritage. And let me just say this, the majority of individuals that come on this podcast, you know, for example, their father is black and their mother is Mexican, and they grew up with their parents, both their parents. That's where my experience is different. And a little bit about, you know, Tori's too. You know, for me, I didn't grow up with any kind of connection to my Vietnamese heritage. Moreover, I've talked extensively about my own resistance to acknowledging my mixed Vietnamese heritage as a result of my white upbringing. Hence the name of the podcast, Multiracial White Boy. I never felt comfortable at all telling others I was born in Vietnam and that I was Vietnamese. But recently, perhaps from all the work I've been doing on myself, and in addition to doing one of those adoption group workshops I just finished, I decided I am Vietnamese. So what does it mean to me to be Vietnamese? What does it mean to me to be Vietnamese? I guess it means that I don't have to hide from it anymore. That I can tell people that I'm close to, that I meet at a party, anywhere, that I'm Vietnamese, and I can tell them this without feeling shame. I am Vietnamese. And saying it with conviction now means that I am not ashamed to be Asian, that I'm adopted, that I grew up with a white family, and that I don't practice or know too much about my Vietnamese culture and heritage. But for once in my life, I felt good about saying this because I feel whole when I declare it. I felt powerful saying it. I felt relief. It felt right and it felt like me. More importantly, it made me realize that my life, my story, it didn't begin when I was adopted to my family in America. My life, my story began in Vietnam, where I was born. During the war, where I had a brother and a sister. I think about them sometimes, even though he passed away when I was a freshman in high school and she found me. We reunited when I was like 29, and I don't know, we don't talk anymore, and she's somewhere in Iowa. I don't know who my father was. You know, that's a whole nother story. But declaring that I am Vietnamese was the first step. And the first step is always the most difficult. Back to Tori. She and I discussed the impact of growing up with our white families. And look, I want to make this very clear. I love my adopted family. Yeah, do I feel a little bit different because I was adopted? Absolutely, but I love them and I have a great relationship with them. Tori has a great relationship with her family, but I also need to, you know, tell you that when I now claim that I'm Vietnamese and Tori now claims that she's Black and Puerto Rican or however she identifies now, we both admitted that our families have had to adjust to our newfound identities. And despite loving them and feeling a sense of belonging, I don't think they knew how badly we were hurting inside and how intentionally erasing our ethnic heritage created a version of ourselves that we were never happy with and were never comfortable sharing with others. This is about us, not them. It's us taking responsibility. That's all. On the other hand, I don't think they realize how empowering it is to finally acknowledge something that we once thought would weaken our sense of belonging. That telling people I am Vietnamese, that they wouldn't accept me. So once again, I am Vietnamese, Tori Puerto Rican. And this is us, me and Tori Sorge, talking things out.
So like my class was a class of 35 kids.
Okay, well, what kind of town are we talking about here? It's in Ohio.
We are talking small town Ohio. So think small town Midwest, maximum population of like 40 to 50,000 people. And you were either Black or you're white. That's it. So the mixed girl, they didn't know what to do with me.
Yeah, okay. So like it was in the 80s and you talked about how, you know, your mom and grandma raised you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, what I'm curious about, what did you hear about your dad when you were growing up? And he was Afro.
So my dad
Puerto Rican.
Yep, exactly. And what I heard about him, so for any single parent out there, I have to say, I think my mom did a phenomenal job, not just in raising me, but I think she did a phenomenal job in managing her own emotions when it came to my dad, because I was 40 before I realized how much hurt there really was under all of that. She never alluded to that as a child. So when I would ask, where's dad? Because he left before I was born. So I did not meet him, have any interaction with him. He was not the dad who stopped by on the weekends or picked me up to take me to a birthday party or, you know, was the fun dad who once in a while would just stop by and take you to Chuck E. Cheese. I had zero contact with him until I was 18. I had one photo, and that photo was of him holding me, and I've posted that on my Instagram. That was the only context I had as to what he looked like and that he actually knew I existed.
Okay, so your mom and your biological mother and I guess your mother.
Yep. Yeah. And, my and mom and dad, I'm biological. I'm not, adopted.
It was, but it was almost like very similar to my story though, in a lot of ways, except that you have, you grew up with your biological parents, but having said that, your father, you didn't know, and you probably heard things about him, but you don't, do you know at all? Like what, like why? Why your mom and him, didn't stick it out or like,
oh,
why,
100%.
What happened? You do know.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Because I also asked him after I met him at 18, I asked him like, hey, what happened? And so what happened was, first of all, he lied about his age when they met. They never got married. It was a short-term relationship of just a couple of months. And when my mom found out that she was pregnant, and mind you, they're not teenagers at this point. My mom was 30 when she had me. And my dad, she thought he was closer to 30. He was actually like 21. He was really young. And the idea of having a child scared him to death. So he was out. He didn't want me. He didn't want to be married. He didn't want a relationship. He didn't want any type of commitment. And so my mom and him had a conversation, and both of them, I've heard the story from both of them, and they both jive. They had a conversation, and my mom said, look, if this is the life you want, fine. The only thing I ask is that you do not come in and out of her life. You will not be that person who makes promises you don't keep, who interrupts her childhood, who gives her a false sense of who she is. You're not going to do that to her.
Wow. She's setting clear boundaries. Like if you're not going to be all in, you can't do it on your own terms then.
Exactly.
If you're going to decide things like that, that you don't want to have this kid. Wow.
Yeah. She was very like, look, you're either all in or you're all out. There's no in between. There's no gray on this one. And he chose to be all out. And after I met him and we talked about this, when he got clean and sober, it was probably around the time that I was around 10, 11 years old. And he really wanted to find me. He really wanted to begin to make amends. You know, part of a 12-step program is making amends. And he wanted to do that with me, but he remembered what he had agreed to and he respected that. So he waited until I sought him out. And if I never did, then he was going to be okay with that because he wanted to respect what he had promised. And especially until I was an adult.
Is he an Ohio native?
No. So he grew up in New York, like a lot of Puerto Ricans. He moved to North Carolina when his mom remarried. They moved to North Carolina, which my dad was by far the darkest in the family. I mean, he looks like a Black man. You know, there's definitely different tones to Caribbean people. And so in our family, we look like Encanto, you know, like you can have every color of skin tone in our family photo. And so he's by far the darkest. And the stories that he has of things like being chased by the KKK, just the abuse that he endured because of his own skin color, which again, I did not learn until I met him and we had conversations. But he grew up, I think at 13, I believe, his mom and stepdad got divorced and she moved with three kids. He's the oldest and he has two siblings and they moved back to Puerto Rico. He'd never really been on the island. He didn't know Spanish. He didn't know the culture. Now my grandma had been there. She'd grown up there. So to her, it was kind of like going home, but to her three kids, it was like throwing them into an entirely different world.
It is.
And he didn't know what to do with that. So that was just on top of the abuse he suffered, that just made things even worse for him. And he didn't spend a lot of time at home. He kind of went to the streets. They wouldn't know where he was for a long time. He would come in and out. So he had a really tough childhood. So it's really hard to be a dad, especially at 21. when you don't know what that even means.
Okay. I want to go back to your, how you grew up. So you grew up with a single mom and a grandmother. Let's backpedal back. What kind of community are we talking about here? And were you the only daughter at this time? Just you and your mom and your grandma?
Yep. So my mom never dated after my dad.
Did you look anything like your mother, like when you were walking around?
Not at all.
Did you get darker during summers where like it became super apparent?
Dude, not to me. So, okay, this is going to sound really weird. So the small town that I grew up in, you were either white or you were black. So like I said earlier, I was 18 before I met another person who looked like me in this town.
Mm.
And she wasn't mixed. She was from India, but she was as close to this as I'd ever seen. And I was a senior in high school. So that gives you kind of the context as to the environment I'm growing up in. My mom is white. So my mom's whole family is white. Not for a second growing up was my color or anything to do with my dad an issue for any one person in my family, not one.
No, well, that's how, you know, it was for me. Mm-hmm. And because I kind of understand where they're coming from. I think the white community kind of embraces that a colorblind mentality. And
100%.
They don't mm-hmm. acknowledge, I don't know if they want to acknowledge it so much, or they just feel like they kind of grasp onto this, I don't know how to say it. This is going to sound awful, but like a white savior mentality, like, you know, what's this, treat her the same, you know, that's more of an adoptee probably mentality.
Maybe. Oh, I could totally see it from an adoptee point of view. Cause for me, they just didn't see me any different.
Right.
Like, and I was just part of the family. When I was with all of my cousins and stuff, not one time did one of them say, "Why do you look different than us?" Not once.
Likewise. But you knew going into those spaces though. Going to family events?
Nope. No. Did not have a clue that I was different until I went to that school. So in fourth grade, when I switched schools and I started going from a public school to a Christian school, that's when for the first time my color and my hair became a question. And it became something I needed to manage because it was definitely a problem for other people.
You know, and I want to talk about that real quick because this is mm-hmm. a big issue for Black women who are mixed and their white mothers who aren't accustomed mm-hmm. to the culture of hair, of Black women's hair.
Mm-hmm.
And you also mentioned that your mom tried to get you to embrace and educate you about Puerto Rican culture, but you were just not having.
I was so resistant, having. So let's talk about.
So how was the hair? How did the hair go?
Because
that's such a big. I didn't realize it was such a big issue with women. Like,
it's huge. Honestly, I think hair. I'm trying to think if it is a 50-50 or if it's actually bigger than skin color. It's definitely at least tied. It could actually be a bigger issue. And this is why I say that, because when you look at somebody, you can see somebody from a distance. And if their hair is large, you're going to see that before you actually see them.
Absolutely.
Okay. And how do we describe people? We describe, especially women, you know, the blonde girl with the green dress on. Okay. A lot of times we will use hair color or hair texture. Oh, you know, that girl with the big curly hair. As a way to describe people. And so when you grow up in an all white environment or a predominantly white environment, you learn real quick that your hair is not like theirs and it doesn't do what theirs does. And and a lot of times for white moms, unless they are intentional about learning how to style and work with and just take care of, it's not managing it. It's not something to be managed. It's something to be cared for. And my mom really tried. I remember her taking me to salons. I remember her taking me to, you know, like Sally's Beauty Supply or these kind of stores where you could find all different kinds of hair products that maybe you couldn't find in your local pharmacy or store. I wasn't having any of it. By the time I was in, or I would say mid elementary school, I didn't want anything that made me different. And going to those stores and going down that aisle and picking up those hair products made me different. I wanted to buy Pantene just like every other girl at school and have long, straight, shiny hair like I saw in commercials.
When your mother takes you to a place like that, you immediately feel different, but you also realize that there's a consumer they're selling that product to. And you're like, I'm that consumer that they're targeting?
Oh, no, I was more like the other side of going, oh, no, I am not.
Well,
no
you, way. That's I what I mean. The resistance is there, but like you're yes. there and you're like, whoa, like, you know, you're that person, but you're just like, I'm out of here. I'm gone. Bye.
Yeah. I'm like, no, because I'm a control freak, especially that's when I started to become one. I realized I wasn't born with that like controlling mentality. It was something I'd learned to develop over time.
Yeah. Cause you're wanting to project a certain kind of persona out there that people will accept. Mm-hmm. And I know all about that from being adopted and mm-hmm. kind of carrying on. What's your last name? Sorge?
Sorgi. But that's my married name. Okay. Yeah.
So what was it? What was your, you know, your
my maiden name was Newfer.
Newfer. You're mm-hmm. part of the Newfer family. And the yep. Newfer family, like the Noonan family, was probably well known, and you wanted to stay in that place.
We really weren't. We were just like, because my mom and my mom grew up in a farming community. And so that was really small. We had moved into, by the time I came along, we were now in the city that was near, about 30 miles away from that farm. But there, think of like country farm community. That's what my mom grew up in. And so I'm growing up as a city girl, as city as the small town is, but it's definitely not, you know, tractors and cornfields. So for her, having that biracial child that doesn't look anything like her, it's not like I worked really darn hard to pass. And I perfected my passing pretty well.
Both internally and externally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Only in those really quiet moments when I was by myself did the internal part ever come up.
What do you mean?
So like if I'm doing getting ready in the morning and I'm by myself in the bathroom, I know how much work I have to put into my hair to make it look white. I know how many products I have to put in. I know how my scalp feels because it's burned from the amount of chemicals that I'm using on it. You know, I know in my heart in those moments, like I'm working really, really hard. I know what I'm sacrificing with my family, like going to the pool with my kids, because I won't go to the pool with my kids because I don't want to risk getting dark. So if we go, trust me, I make it miserable for everybody. Everybody knows mom didn't want to be there. Now, that's different today, but that was the mom my kids grew up with. My kids grew up with the mom who, do we have to go to Florida to go to Disney World? Because humidity and this are not going to get along.
Oh man. So, okay. So you like myself, you talked about all the racist taunting you got, and obviously mm-hmm. the reason why you scooted over to whiteness. And I ditched my Vietnamese heritage early on. I came here with a Vietnamese brother. We were adopted into different families, but then he passed away when I was a kid. And after he passed away, that was my only source of like, oh, that's your Vietnamese brother. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. once that he was out of my life, I was like, I don't even want any part of that because it just was just directly rooted.
It's painful.
It's directly rooted in pain. Yes.
It's so, pain and trauma.
Yeah. It's pain and trauma. And, but I was wondering with all the resistance you did, but was there a moment, I guess, in college or when you went outside of your community, where people no longer saw you as Tori Sorge? And you were like, oh, I'm this way. They're starting. In other words, all that passing wasn't working anymore.
Nope.
Really?
No. I would say the only time I can remember that it slipped was after my husband and I got married. And we were at dinner with my new brother-in-law and his wife. And we're sitting there. I mean, we've been married just a few months. We dated for about a year. So I knew my new family members. I didn't know them super well. So we're sitting at dinner and my brother-in-law looks at us and he goes, so what's it like being in an interracial marriage? Okay. Now I married into a white family. So my husband is white. His whole family is white. I was the first person in the family that was now not, unbeknownst to me. Like, I still think I am, right? And both of us looked at each other like we were shocked. And my husband looked at him and he was like, what are you talking about? Like, we didn't see it. So I remember going home that night thinking to myself, like not articulating any of it, just internally going, I need to do better. Like, okay, note taken. Somebody was able to see through it. We need to do better. So I just kept working harder.
The do better wasn't like we need, instead of saying the do better expression for acknowledging your racial identity, it was more, need to do better of hiding it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. I guess I kind of did somewhat of the same, but I just didn't verbally express it. Cause like I used to get,
I didn't until recently. Like,
yeah, you mentioned that and I'll go to that in a second, but that's when you were kind of outed and I'm sure. Okay. So this, I want to backtrack here real quickly. So this is super interesting because you're a control freak in the sense that you're just trying to control your racial identity so nobody knows, so you could pass. Mm-hmm. Then your brother-in-law mm-hmm. outs you.
Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst to him, he doesn't think he's saying.
So did they know that your father was Afro-Latino, basically?
Yeah. Like, so when I met my husband, I met my dad when I was 18. When we met, shortly thereafter, I started dating this Mexican guy. When I was dating him, my dad didn't know how to be a dad. He'd never been one, really. And so he took on this overprotective mode, and which led to a split in our relationship. So for 18 years, I didn't need him to pick my friends or help me know which boy to date or any of these things. And now all of a sudden he thinks that we've reconnected and now he has the right to tell me what to do and who to date and all of this. And I was like,
let's talk about that reconnection. Did you guys have an arrangement? Were you guys going to meet at like a restaurant or like somewhere?
Oh no, that's its own story. So we met for the first time the night before my high school graduation.
Oh, Jesus. Sorry. I should have said that. Okay. Sorry. I got a sailor's mouth on me that.
Hey.
Sorry.
It's totally fine. It's good. I get it.
The night before your graduation?
Mm-hmm. For the first time.
Was that intentional on his part? Because he had a daughter out there that. Okay.
No. What happened? So backpedaling to that, I had had a very strained relationship with his mother. So I had met my paternal grandma a few times, none of which were very pleasant meetings. And so out of respect, I felt like I should probably send her a graduation announcement and let her know, hey, your oldest grandchild is graduating from high school. Not looking for anything, just letting you know. And my mom said the day that I did that, she goes, just be prepared. She didn't say I couldn't do it. She just said, just be prepared for what this could bring. Because she knew that it had the potential of opening a door that we had kind of shut. Sure enough, it did. And when she called and started to have a conversation, she asked, your dad would like to meet you. Is that something he'd like to at least have a conversation with you? Is that something that you'd be open to? Of course, I've wanted to meet him my whole life. So, and now I had worked through a lot of anger and a lot of resentment and a lot of hurt. So I was kind of at a good place in my life to have.
Yeah, and you still have those questions of like, who am I? Kind of like an adoptee in a way. Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
This person was never in your life.
Right. And I wanted to know, from the time I was little, I prayed that God would just let me meet him. I didn't need to have a relationship. I didn't even care if it was just meeting him from across the room. So I could see him in person. That's all I ever wanted.
So what did God really give you that night before your graduation?
Well, first he gave me a phone conversation 2 weeks before just to say hi and get to know each other.
Yeah.
And mind you, this is 1997. There wasn't Zoom. There wasn't FaceTime. There wasn't Skype. There wasn't video. So we are just having a phone conversation. There's still no visuals. He asked if he could come to my graduation. And I was like, yeah, I would love to meet you. And so the night before, he flew in the night before graduation. And so I remember sitting at the gate. This was at a time when it was still when you could go to the gate to meet people before 9/11, because you were able to, there wasn't security there like TSA now. So you could go and sit at the gate and wait for somebody to get off the plane.
Oh, right.
And so I remember sitting at the gate waiting and watching people get off the plane. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, well, how will I know it's him? How will I know which one is him?
Oh, I bet because when he came out there, you knew.
It was just like, he walked off. He was one of the last people off the plane and he walked off and he looked at me and I looked at him and we just knew. Yeah. And so for me, that was a really sweet time. So fast forward year later. So I'm dating this guy, this Mexican guy, and my dad gets all machismo on the whole thing. And I knew he was having us followed. I knew because I kept seeing the same guy every place my boyfriend and I went. And I told him, I said, I know we're being followed. My dad has hired an investigator. I can guarantee you. And it was several years later before my dad finally confessed that that's exactly what he did.
Why did he hire?
Because he wanted to make sure that I was safe. Like he had this overprotective dad, like he's making up for lost time. So all of a sudden he feels this need to protect his daughter, where I don't feel as though I need protecting. I've been fine. Nothing's happened to me in 18, 19 years. I'm good. And so that led to a rift in our relationship, and which caused us then not like, I kind of broke up with my dad. I ended up breaking up with the guy too, but, I broke up with my dad and we didn't speak for 3 years. And in those 3 years, I met my husband and we got married and my husband realized. So my brother-in-law, back to him, he hadn't met my dad. It's not like my dad walked me down the aisle. No one in their family knew who he was. They just knew he was Puerto Rican and that was it. So he wasn't a part of our wedding. He wasn't a part of my life at that time again. But my husband realized shortly after we got married that that really bothered me and that I really wanted to at least reach out to him. And so he encouraged me to send him an email and just see if we could maybe mend this bridge. And sure enough, he was more than willing. And so we reconnected again. And then that that led to the rest of our relationship. So you asked what God gave me. I asked just to be able to see him from across the room. And God gave me what ended up being 20 years with him before he passed away.
Did he go to your graduation?
He did. That picture's on my Instagram too. It's the only picture I have of my mom and dad and I together.
I'm just shocked that he went to your graduation, because I think it's fair to say that you hid everything about him and about you. And then why did you make the decision to have him be present there?
I think because I always wanted him to be a part of my life.
I was going to say that. I always
wanted him to be a part of my life. Had I grown up with him as a part of my life, and had his life been in a place where he could have been a dad, things would have been very different. I don't think I would have chosen to hide to the extent that I did, because I wouldn't have had to answer questions all the time about why I looked the way I did, because my mom and dad walk into a room, it would have been obvious why I looked the way I do. There would have been a point of reference, not just to myself, but to others, as to my appearance, which may have led to their own set of issues, who knows, but at least there would have been some context.
Yeah.
No, I got really tired of answering questions and dealing with providing context to my life that I myself didn't even understand.
Absolutely. I've talked about that recently on the latest podcast that, that when people ask me, what are you and where are you from? Look, I think those questions are fine if you're well-intended. And I don't consider microaggressions like so many other, these younger people do. But what it was for me, it wasn't just my mix. Am I totally multiracial? Absolutely. But what it was rooted in was my adoption story and where I came from. And that, you know, my birth happened during the war. And that apparently my mother was one of those women that was like with a lot of like American soldiers or whatever to survive, which you had to do.
Right.
And then I had a Vietnamese sister, and then I had a Vietnamese brother. So it was all these things that were rooted in kind of separation, in tragedy, and in drama. And it was just stuff I didn't know a lot about. And there were questions that were unanswered.
And let's be honest, you have those questions yourself. Like,
yes.
I was at a speaking engagement recently, and I said about my dad, when I was little, I would hear, you know, well, where's your dad? And I said, I wanted to know the same thing. Like, where are you? I don't know. Like, when you ask those questions of someone, you are dredging up pain and trauma unbeknownst to you. That's not your intent. Your intent is to ask a question.
Yeah.
You have no idea the amount of inner turmoil that you're stirring up in that person when you ask even the simple question of, what are you?
So it wasn't until 2020 that you came to the crossroads. You finally decided you couldn't be living the lie and all the work that you had done doing in terms of passing.
Right.
So my feeling is that, did it happen because of George Floyd? Did that have a lot to do with it? Okay, let's talk about that.
It did. It did. So May 2020, my family is getting ready to get out of town because we're in the middle of the pandemic. We can't really go on vacation. All of our vacations that we had planned for that year had been canceled. And we needed a change of scenery. So a friend had a cabin in Utah, which is really, it's like 3 hours from where we live here in Vegas. And so we went up to the woods and got in a cabin and hung out, that was as close to getting out of town as we could get. So I'm sitting in the cabin, and before we left, I was packing, you know, the cooler, packing up the car, and the news is on in the background in the living room. And I can hear the story about George Floyd But I'll be completely transparent. It didn't do anything. Like, it was background news noise in my home, just like Ahmaud Arbery's story a few weeks before had been. I felt bad for the family. Man, these things are terrible. Why do these things keep happening? Oh, hey, don't forget, we need more Coke. Do you have the other, you know, I mean, it was that routine, that honestly, that meaningless to me. Little did I know God was going to use that in a whole different way, because we're sitting in the cabin and I'm by myself. My family had all gone to do other things. And I'm on Instagram because this cabin had good Wi-Fi. And I'm on Instagram and I'm scrolling and I'm seeing all these black squares. I have no idea what these black squares mean because we've been kind of off the grid for 24 hours by this point. And I quickly realized just from scrolling further that these squares are in solidarity to what has happened in regards to the killing of George Floyd. And I cannot explain what happened inside me, but I went from being somebody who didn't honestly faze me all that much, to somebody who, like, my stomach hurt. I felt nauseous. I didn't know why I had this inner turmoil going on. I couldn't make sense of it. And I didn't understand why all of a sudden this was bothering me. And that was kind of the catalyst that led to me going, God, I don't know what you're doing, but something is happening. And my family could tell it. I mean, from the minute they walked back into the cabin from where they had been all day, they walked in and within about 15, 20 minutes, our teenage son was like, Mom is in a mood. What is wrong with her? And I'm like, I don't know what's going on with me, but something, like, I couldn't articulate it yet. It took about 2 or 3 weeks for me to wrestle through these emotions. And what was happening was I was being confronted with what I had done. And for the first time, I recognized that I'm very good at compartmentalizing. And my dad was Puerto Rican, but I was not. Okay. So I hid all of that. My dad was super proud of it. And for the first time, I watched what happened to George Floyd, and I put my dad in that position. And I was like, so for me now, all of a sudden, it became personal. And that's what changed. When I was able to take an event and make it personal for myself, I couldn't hide anymore. And I'm like, I can't live like this anymore. People are dying. And I can't do this. And I can't keep living this lie. And I don't know what this is going to mean for me, but I know it's going to be painful, because it was painful when I got to this point when I was 10. So I know what I'm agreeing to return to, but I can't live a lie anymore.
So now that you've moved on and you have a sense of new version of who you are, mm-hmm. How has this version been met with friends and community and family?
I'm not going to lie. There have been times where I've had to filter all of the comments and some of the things that I had to filter, you know, questions about my hair or people touching my hair. I don't know why that has to be a thing, but it is. Like, I wouldn't go up and touch somebody else that's a stranger and just start touching their hair, but it happens. And sometimes those things can be triggers to things that happened in your childhood. And so knowing that I was going to have to revisit probably some of those things, I have. But for my family, remember, my husband married this other version of me, and that's the only mom my kids have known. So they have had to adjust and accept this new version of myself. And I think probably one of the most beautiful pieces of all of this is my husband has been waiting 20 years for me to be this person.
That's because, so funny. Wow. Like they know.
He knew. I don't know if my kids really did, but my husband was always like, babe, would you just put a baseball cap on if you don't like your hair today? Just put a baseball cap on. Let's go. Let's go have fun with the kids. Let's go do this. I want you to be a part of this. He saw me for who I was long before I could. And he loved that girl long before I could even accept her. And so he's been waiting 20 years for me to be this version of myself. And honestly, I don't know if he could be much more proud, because and the kids have been so accepting, like so excited. They have their own questions. It's opened up opportunities for us to talk about family history. In 2020 for my birthday, our son bought me a DNA kit from Ancestry so that I could learn more about this, and not just for myself, but for our family. And what does this mean? And who are we? And just diving into all that is has been a little scary and exciting both for our family as a whole. It's been painful for my mom.
But that's what I was curious about, because like your mom early on in your life was the one that was trying to put you in contact and make a connection mm-hmm. with your dad's side of the family. And because she sounded like she knew how important it would be. And that
100%.
Moment would come. So why? Yep. Okay. So
why is it hard for her now?
Yes.
Because all along, because my mom was a single mom and I was the only child she ever had. So she poured her life into me. And so along that road, she has watched from, I'm going to say even from a distance, because as an adult, she knew she couldn't make choices for me. She couldn't necessarily give her two cents on what she thought I should be doing, because I'm an adult now. But as a kid, she watched her daughter hurt. She watched her daughter go through through situations that she, as a mom, couldn't control. She couldn't control what the kids at school said. And I'll be honest, I hid a lot of it from her. And that's been hard for her. Through this, as things have come out, and through my writing, as I revisit things and I share things, these are things she never knew. She never knew how bad my day-to-day school life really was. And so there's a level of pain and regret on her part now of like, I should have done more. I didn't know.
You know
I'm
what?
So
I didn't think
sorry.
About, I didn't think about that, because my mom, when I did like a 6-week adoption course recently, mm-hmm. and even through the podcast, like they just don't say much about it.
Yeah.
But I think that unfortunately they make it about themselves.
Yes. Yes.
And they don't realize it's not about them. This is just something you're going through. But at the same time, it's funny because I didn't realize it, like that they probably realized like, God, was I a shitty mother?
Yeah. And she's like,
no, you did great.
Just
love me. And you did all the supportive things and all those things.
And you
things.
Couldn't know what I didn't tell you.
The way I was processing things, I didn't know how I was feeling at that time. I just know I just know that I didn't have a sense of belonging. So I hid everything.
I made myself belong.
However,
as
best I could.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Interesting.
And
and
as a single mom, I knew that she was doing her dangdest every day just to provide me with this privileged life she gave me. Because I cannot deny that I lived a very privileged life. And that does not diminish the fact, though, that I have experienced racism, microaggression, trauma, pain. It doesn't diminish those things at all. But
and
I
it's
also
weird because it's
deny.
Somewhat self-inflicted, you know, like,
yeah, probably. Yeah.
You know, cause I think about that, you know, and yes, there's a lot of it, but yeah, some of it's self-inflicted because what you and me chose to do, and how to react to it back then. But at the same time, it's totally understandable. I wish I was that kid to be like, no, I'm me, I'm Vietnamese, and I'm this, and like, I'm going to show up that way. But
you also knew that was a lonely road too.
That was like, going to be, yes.
Almost worse. Like, let's be honest. That's probably, and especially in the 80s.
And yeah, and no one was like, even like when my Vietnamese brother passed away when I was a freshman in high school, no one knew that I had a Vietnamese brother. Everyone knew I was the Vietnamese adopted kid, but no one knew I had a brother. So I couldn't tell anyone at school.
Right. So now how are you processing your own grief? You can't even share it now
in this life. Right. Later. Trust me, I've been paying for it the last couple of months. But yeah, I had nowhere to process it. Mm-hmm. And it's been just, it's kind of like that moment that you had in Utah, that those mm-hmm. moments I've had a lot lately since I did that adoptee thing where, you know, first this podcast was the first step in acknowledging my racial identity, mm-hmm. but it's rooted in the dirt of it and soil of it is rooted in whiteness, but the roots underneath is my Vietnamese heritage. And so now I'm just trying to plant my own garden.
Yeah. I said, and isn't it cool how those roots kind of transition as they go deeper?
Oh God. The deeper they go,
like they're all intertwined, you know, like you pull roots out, they're all like this.
My mixed identity and my adoption are very much intertwined. And I didn't realize that as much. Talking about it on this podcast made me open myself up to it because that's where like my racial identity was created. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to go to the questions that you and I sent.
Those were fun last night.
Yeah, let's see how they go today.
Okay.
So I never do this on the podcast, but I wanted to do this specifically with you because everything you're telling me is fucking frightening as hell to me because I feel like I'm reliving my own past and my own patterns of behavior. Everything.
It's freaking scary.
It's really
scary. This has been just when I thought 2020 was the hardest year. Right? Then we got to 2022 or 2021 and holy crap. I thought 2020 was hard. 2021. I sat at Christmas and I was just bawling and I'm like, my son was home from college and he's like, what is going on? Like, why did I come home? This is crazy. Like, seriously, this has been the hardest year of my life.
Yeah.
Sorting all of this junk out. It's like going through triage is what I compared it to.
Interesting.
Like you're opening all of these old infected wounds and pouring disinfectant on all of them at the same time. So all of that bubbling is happening, but it's got to happen for it to heal.
Yeah. And it's
holy crap.
It's weird because it goes against the tendency of being a control freak and wanting quick solutions to things. Right.
Yes. Cause I've learned I've had to surrender that control. Like I don't really have a whole lot of control on how this plays out from here on out, you know?
No.
I'm along for the ride and I don't know what it's going to look like, but I know that either. There's some chains breaking.
But I do know that I have to, what I've learned though. Yes, exactly. I don't know, but I know from now on, I have to be more of an advocate for myself.
Right.
As a person of color and where I'm from. Okay. This was,
and for me, I have to be an advocate for others too.
Yes. Because and others. That's what I would say as well.
There's a lot of people who haven't found this voice yet.
And that's why I started the podcast. Cause it was like, yes. Okay, I gotta like,
yes.
Honestly, it was right after George Floyd as well, because like I grew up with so many.
What did that mean for you?
For me, it meant that, okay, that I was tired of hearing the same old racial tropes and just racism about why George Floyd didn't cooperate, you know, and things like that.
From
family members.
How did he get himself in this mess? Well, he shouldn't have been there. Well, yeah. He'd have just done.
Like, it doesn't happen to people like them, essentially.
So my husband works in law enforcement. So you can imagine the conversations we've had at home.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And a lot of it was that I got to show up for being a person of color. Because a long time ago, I did a film about my Vietnamese heritage and my Vietnamese sister tracked me down and it did well. But that was like my one-off. Like I was like, okay, I'm good now. You know, like I got it out of my system. But,
yes.
You know, unfortunately, just coming back. Okay. First one, in regards to community and white privilege.
Okay.
Was there a sense of white privilege extended to you, and or were you a de facto member of the white community because of your family?
Yes and yes. Yes, it just kind of happened because I was in a white family. I can't deny that. I mean, if I had been in a Puerto Rican family or a Black family or a Mexican family or some, my experience would have been extremely different. And it would be really naive and actually pretty terrible of me to try to say it wouldn't have been. So, 'cause it would be a complete lie. Yeah. What was the first part of the question? So definitely de facto.
Yeah. Well, I guess, was there a sense of extended white privilege? For example, when I went out of my community for the first time in college, I wasn't in Noonan. People didn't see me that way. And I came to school really tan and dark from surfing all summer. And people finally saw me as like, they thought I was Hawaiian, Latino. Mm-hmm. I was like, holy shit. It was for the reasons that you didn't want to go sunbathe in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
But I always thought like I look good in the tan or like good dark, but I didn't realize like they're seeing me as a dark person. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I love swimming, for example. You love surfing. I love swimming. I forgot how much I loved swimming until I started going through old family photos during this process. And I saw pictures of me as a 5-year-old, 6-year-old little girl with my wet ringlets. And all of a sudden, I remembered how much I loved those summer days and how much I lived for being at the pool. And I stopped doing that when I was 10 or 11, because just like you, I went back to school in the summer. And the first thing out of kids' mouths was, "You are so dark." I didn't even think about it. I thought I was having fun at the pool, but I realized real quick I had to not have fun at the pool anymore. We didn't go bike riding around the block in the summer. We didn't hang out at the park anymore.
You deprived yourself of so much joy. It's amazing.
Uh-huh. Like,
it's amazing what fear will do.
We call it white privilege.
Yeah.
There's also a mirror to that. That's like the other side of the mirror where it's not a privilege. To fit into this white dominant culture requires a massive sacrifice.
It does. And what unfortunately happened to me, and I'm going to ask you if it happened to you as well, of feeling this extended kind of de facto member of the white community, kind of like an honorary status. was that, I don't know how else to say it. I embraced to a good extent, the mentality of white supremacy. And that
I would agree I did too.
And that I grew up with very conservative Reagan parents. I heard the N-word, not so much within my family, but maybe extended people around the family, or I heard my Aunt Millie saying the slant eyes and stuff like that to me because they grew up in, you know, World War II in Hawaii. And when I heard that, I knew I have like that sense of like, oh, wow, that was bad. That was wrong. But how I would react was like, you got to be like these people in a way. Maybe not say it bluntly, but you got to share the same attitude if you want to kind of belong.
I think for me, I actually did share the same attitude. Like, I mean, the jokes that I not only would laugh at, but the jokes that I would say that I came up with on my own, you know,
it's so dehumanizing when you think about it. Like
it totally is. And I knew, so I recognized probably 8-9 years ago that we talk a lot at church about how Jesus loved people. He just loved them. Right. And I realized I did not love people the way that Jesus loved people. And that needed to change. And I didn't know how to change it. So I just started praying, God, would you change my heart and help me see people the way you see people? And he started to do that. It wasn't like a light switch or anything, but over time I recognized I had this increased compassion. I had this increased empathy for people that were different than me. And I couldn't really tell where it came from, but I'm like, well, duh, you've been praying for it. Why do you think you don't know where it came from now? But my family started to see that because I would start to vocalize like, guys, that's not really funny. And then they'd say, well, seriously, you're the one who makes the jokes. Like, why are they not funny all of a sudden?
Yeah.
And I couldn't really articulate the shift for them, but I just knew like, so I just kept every time it would happen, I kind of became the buzzkill, but I'm like, these aren't funny anymore. Like these sayings aren't necessary. If it's not bringing, like, if there's not a value to what we're talking about, why are we saying it?
Yeah.
And so those are the things.
I'm Asian. I can make jokes about it, but if it's thoughtful or not dehumanizing, it's clearly I have problems with that particular race.
Right. Exactly.
Culture, you know,
and I love,
there's no perfect culture and whatever, but still.
But I love what you talked about with your aunt, for example, because there's this question that that was posed by Rich Belotus in his book, The Deeply Formed Life. And said, who are you taught to fear? And I just meditated on that because I realized that a lot of the mentality that I had about other people had nothing to do with my own experiences. Now, I had my own experiences and I had my own opinions of people based on those experiences, but I had a lot that had nothing to do with people I actually had met. They were things that had been passed down generationally that were the way that other people in our family saw people was now how I saw people, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I mean, I without going into specifics, you know, those kind of people.
What neighborhood are you? Do you drive around so you don't have to drive through it?
Right. Or don't bring home kids from that neighborhood. Like just all that
stuff.
Or
you can date everybody except.
Yeah.
Like why can't I date them?
Oh man. Okay. Next one. I don't have much relationship with my Vietnamese heritage. But I want to know if you have had much of a relationship or started embracing your Puerto Rican culture.
Puerto Rican side?
Yeah. Puerto Rican side.
So that is kind of a loaded question. So my dad, once I met him, learned very quickly that he was actually extremely well-known both in Hollywood and within the Puerto Rican community. So he was a salsa dancer. He was a producer, promoter. He was a Puerto Rican historian and he worked on movie sets. He worked on as a choreographer, especially for anything that had to do with salsa dancing or salsa scenes or things like that. And now some of the people who have worked with him or that he mentored during that time were a part of things like In the Heights and some of those type of things now. So that was the world I got thrown into at 18 when I met him. He was that guy. Like at 18, I went from conservative Christian school on Thursday to flying to Puerto Rico to hang out with my family for a week for 7 days, and I stayed at my grandma's house, and she took me around the island, as did my uncle. And I learned about family members. I learned about a little bit about the culture, but I learned so much more from my dad about the culture because he was engrossed in it. It was his desire to pass it down to the next generation, that if we don't pass these things down, they will, these history will die, and we can't allow that to happen. And so that was who my dad was like. And when I got to LA the week, so I spent 1 week in Puerto Rico. The next week I went directly from San Juan to Los Angeles. Never been to California in my life. This 18-year-old gets off the plane, meets this, let's be honest, virtual stranger who just happens to be her dad, and gets in a black Excursion and spends the next 7 days with, you have your security, you have velvet ropes, you have nightclubs every night, you have an entirely different life than anything I had ever been exposed to. So he loved everything about Puerto Rican culture. I tried at times to embrace it, and I don't know the language. I didn't really understand all of it. And at the time, I wasn't in a place yet to embrace it. That was still his culture. That was his stuff. That was him. Now, through this last 2 years, I have done a lot of deep dive into family history, asking questions, learning more about the culture. And what I've come to decide for myself, and this is going to be a super weird conclusion, I think, for most people, is that my culture and my ethnicity are very separate things for me. Again, I compartmentalize everything. So I am Puerto Rican. I know that's part of who I am. But my culture is, if I went to another country, I am an American girl. I love, like, that's my culture. American culture is my culture.
That is me too.
And if you asked me like, okay, what is it that you love about your culture? I do love salsa dancing, and I do love the food, and I do love the family dynamics. But I'm an American girl, and I love Sunday football, and I love, I love Disneyland, and I love reality TV, and I love American culture. That's who I am. And why do I have to now forfeit that to embrace this other culture that honestly is foreign to me?
Yeah. And I
think, and it doesn't feel who I am. As much as I've tried to push it in there, it's yeah. just, there's aspects, yes, but not as a, it's not me.
Yeah. Cause it blows me away. Cause there's like a couple of mixed people that are adopted or whatever, and they like literally changed their names, their Americans' names, because they know that their heritage was erased. So now they go back and
they're making up for lost time.
Yeah, they're making up for lost time. However, I just look, and that's their decision. And
100%.
They should be proud of it, and they should own it. But I know for me too, it's both the fear of feeling like an imposter, but it's knowing more than anything that what is me, truly me, mm-hmm. what is an American culture that likes movies and likes football
yep.
and barbecues and whatever constitutes to, you know, apple pie and
yes.
whatever we've kind of created out of this, you know, excessive mess of what is American culture. But yeah. Okay. So the last,
but good one, or bad, that's all, that's me.
That's what I mean. Culture, but the good
and the bad.
I'm glad that you were frank and honest with that, because everyone, you shouldn't get shit for that, is what I'm saying.
I agree.
And you shouldn't get shit for that.
And I think in our current climate, you do.
You absolutely can.
You do. And I'm like, well, you can chip me for it. I've been chipped my whole life. I'm not going to.
Right.
You know, this is, This is who, this is me. So take it or leave it.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So, okay. So talking about my mixed identity started to peel away like so many layers and ultimately led me to deal with my adoption story, like I've mentioned here.
Yes.
So after years of resistance of denying your Puerto Rican side, what have you discovered about yourself that was beyond your sense of denial? Like, what was at the root?
The root of the hiding or the root of...
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I guess my at the root was like, oh, I have to deal with adoption. That's bad. Maybe, like, what was at the root? Or was it?
I think at the deepest root, not to over spiritualize things, but I can't tell my story without God being a part of my story. And so for me, it was, I attributed all of my dad's characteristics to God. So because we talk about God being like this heavenly father, and I couldn't equate what that was. So even though I grew up in the church, I grew up with this idea that I knew that God loved me, and I knew that he was for me, and I knew his promises, and I knew my Bible. I knew that I knew that I knew. But I knew that stuff didn't apply to me. It applied to other people because my dad left. So how do I know that you really won't leave? Even though you say you won't.
So it connected you to your relationship with your spirituality and God.
Yeah. 100%.
Was like, because was the other thing a facade maybe? And that what you're doing now is truly the work of God, of loving and embracing yourself maybe.
That's what I believe. That's what I believe to be true. Because when I said earlier that I prayed that God would give me eyes to see people the way he sees people, and he's done that in 2020, it was like he looked at me and went, now it's time to do that for you. It's time to let you see yourself the way I see you, because you've gotten really good at having compassion and empathy for others. I need you to have compassion and empathy for the girl I created, not the one you created, because you did a really good job of creating this persona of yourself, but that's not who I created you to be. I created you to be Tori, and you keep hiding her. And I have amazing plans for her, but she can't do them if you keep hiding her.
Exactly. You keep hiding who you are. And like, it's funny because my Vietnamese name is called Lin Phi Long, which means running dragon. And
that's super cool name.
says it. But they're like, but I've always thought about that. I was like, okay, running dragon. Like, you got to stop running though, too. And running, you know, I don't know how to say it, but like, it's taking care and owning your story and planting it firmly in the ground. You're right. And my adoption story was that, like, I have to own that. I have to realize that I'm from there and stop blocking all these things that are holding me back because of it.
And denying that they never existed.
And denying
that doesn't work. Like, you can't just say, oh, the past was bad. I don't want to deal with that. So let's just move on. Like, there has to be a period of lament. Like, there has to be a period of not just acknowledgement, but of ownership. Like, I did a lot of terrible things to myself so that I could be somebody I wasn't created to be.
Yeah.
You know, and I need to own those things. And there was a season where I had to just sit and lament and cry over those things and grieve them. And I had to even grieve those times when I denied my kids and my husband of this person that I was supposed to be all along. And even going, man, God, why did it have to take 30 years? Why did I have to take so long to get it through my head? I could have been doing this work years ago. And he keeps reminding me, for such a time as this. For such a time as now.
Yeah. And
nothing is wasted.
Look, there's people in their lives that never get to it. And exactly. I've thought about that too. Like, why is this happening? Like in the ugly part of my 40s, like, come on, I'm supposed to have a film career right now. Like, you know, but I've, you know, I've realized
we're in therapy.
Yeah. You know, but like, but I've realized that, you know, it would have mattered if I would have addressed it in my 20s, my 30s, or when I would have really leaned into it now. Mm-hmm. It was going to happen no matter what. And at least I've surrendered to it.
I think that's the key right there, honestly, yeah. Is surrender.
Oh God, there's so much resistance that I've put there's out. Jesus.
You, me, I think there's so much resistance we put out and there's so much resistance we come up against that eventually the resistance back and forth, that tension is exhausting.
It is. And it's an inner tension. Yeah. Okay. Your questions. Well, you have three.
Yes.
So as a transracial adoptee, yeah. I'll read them.
Good.
So as a transracial adoptee, do you feel a tie to your culture? Or do you feel your culture is a result of one you were raised in? I think I kind of answered that question.
Yeah. I think you've raised, yeah.
Earlier, but there's no doubt that like when people like I'm planning a trip and people are like, when they say like, don't you want to go to Vietnam? And they trip out when I'm like, no, I'm like, I want to go to Paris or I want to go to Italy or Prague. Cause like, they don't realize like going to, at least for me going there,
that's not a vacation.
It's not a vacation. It's serious. You, like going into an orphanage.
Hard work.
Yeah. It turns into personal work and, you know, opening up of old wounds and memories and, you know, cause like, you know,
you might do that trip sometime.
Oh but
that
yeah. There's no doubt
that, but that trip will have an completely different motive.
Right.
Like you know, when you get on that plane, you're not going to sit with a Mai Tai in your hand. You're going with the intention of coming home a different person.
Discovery. And look, that's mm-hmm. all good, but I don't know. I really
but so
don't.
Is Paris.
But so is Paris. All right. Did your adoptive parents expose you to Vietnamese children growing up or anything tied to your biological culture? There was this one kid named Peter Pham when I went to Catholic school and he was Vietnamese. And I remember like, I guess my parents, my mom particularly arranged like what would be considered a play date back then. And I just felt so out of place. His family was speaking Vietnamese. Peter never spoke a word. He was totally quiet. I just remember being uncomfortable the entire time with his family and going. And now that I think about it, it's like, just because I'm blood related as a Vietnamese person doesn't mean I'm going to get along with Vietnamese people. It's like saying, hey, there's this, like, if you live like in, you know, an indigenous community and like you're, mm-hmm. there's another white kid and you grew up as a white kid, like, hey, you know, I think you're going to get along with this kid because of his skin like, color.
Because
or his culture.
We look alike. Yeah.
Or that, you know, just because like there's language, there's culture, there's things. So they did not have the tools back then in the 80s that they do
I
now.
I think that was for parents across the board.
Like, no doubt. Yeah.
Like those of us who are now in our late 30s and 40s, who grew up in the 80s and the early 90s, and we have kids and we're watching TV shows and we're seeing things that are dredging up stuff for us. It's because we didn't have that when we were a kid. Like we didn't have TV shows who had people who looked like us.
No.
We didn't have Disney characters who looked like us.
It was all centered around white people and whiteness. And that's why I wanted mm-hmm. to be that.
Right.
Because that was the beauty standards. That was the athletes. That was the John
Hughes
everything.
Films.
Yeah.
Right. Like I remember growing up and I remember the first person I saw on TV who I thought looked like me was on A Different World. And it was a spinoff of The Cosby Show. And her name's Jasmine Guy.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
of course.
And I loved Whitley because Whitley looked like me. And even though I was probably like, you know, 13, 14 at the time, and this is a show about college kids, I didn't care what the premise was. I cared that there was a person on TV who looked like me.
Yeah.
Because representation matters.
It's so weird. Like there was, I think the only one that looked like me when I was a kid, it was Raiders of the Lost Ark, like Key, the Asian kid. But then I think when I was in college, people were like, you look like that guy on Superman with Terry Hatcher and Dean Cain.
Oh, I remember those, but I didn't watch the episode. So
it was a terrible show. Okay. It's been,
but even that, we're side characters.
Yeah, we're side. No.
When we were on TV, we were a side character. We weren't a main character.
They still are, though. I've been paying more attention to that. And even though there's more diversity on what you're seeing on TV, there's still.
It's a step.
Back road. Yeah, I know. But it's a step where, like, how long is it going to take, too? It's exhausting steps.
Yes. It's like that stair stepper at the gym when you just keep walking, but it feels like you're going nowhere.
Yeah. And you wonder, okay, when are we going to get there?
Yeah.
Okay. Last one. It's been very difficult for my mom, as we've talked about this. Okay. For my mom, I've been on this journey of self-discovery. Have your parents been open to your desire to explore your heritage? I do want to talk about this. Not so much the desire to explore my heritage. I don't think they know that I don't have much of a desire, probably. Doing this for myself and probably yourself of journey of self-discovery is honestly to have a better understanding of who I am and to heal it. What about you?
100%. 100%. Like this is not my mom's journey. My mom has her own stuff to deal with as these things unfold. And it may open wounds for her that she has to deal with, but she also recognizes that this is my journey. And it does not in any way, me discovering the side of myself does no way diminish the years, the sacrifice, the love, everything she poured into me. It doesn't take a moment of that away. And I think sometimes that's something that individually our parents have to remind themselves of. Because if you're a parent and you're listening to this and your kids are teenagers, maybe now, there's going to be a time when maybe they identify as one of you and not as the other. That in no way diminishes the fact that you are their parent and you love them. And they are not rejecting you per se. They are trying to figure it out.
Yeah. It just kills me inside when they make it about themselves because I want to lash out at them, but then I'm like, what's the point?
Right.
It's a long time ago.
And that's their pain. That's their own. Exactly. That's their insecurity. That's their pain. That's their fear of rejection. Their fear of maybe losing something that they desperately love.
I think that's what it is though, in a lot of ways. Cause I think this is my theory. Whenever I talk to someone who's mixed, they're like, well, what was it like having a black dad or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, well, he was just my dad. And that is their relationship to you. I'm just their son and you're just their daughter. Mm-hmm. And when you start acknowledging the external part of like, I'm this person and I'm a person of color and I think it's hard for them to let go of the person that they've attached themselves to their entire lives. And that's mm-hmm. protected you and done all this, invested in you. And now it's shifting in a way that they didn't see coming. And it's going to be what it is.
It does feel like rejection on
their part. Yeah. And I think
it feels like they're being rejection.
Yeah. But I think they're just so attached to a certain, it's like me seeing my little nephews growing up, I can't get it out of my head that this kid's still, he's still like this little kid to me.
Yep.
And it's hard for me to realize, oh, he's starting to drive. He's starting like kids. And
that's a nephew. Now imagine that being your son. Your
son, right. Or your you daughter, know, my God.
Right. Imagine that being the person that you brought home from the hospital or you brought home from the airport, you know, and that you stayed up at nights with them. You nursed them when they were sick. You fought and with them. You loved them. You did all of those things because you desperately loved them. And now they're going through something that seems to push all of that love aside. Like all of that didn't matter. All that matters is this idea that you could be somebody different. When they look at you and go, but the person you are is the person I love.
Okay, I want to end this on you to respond to this. After your personal awakening a couple years ago and the work that you're doing now, and you're doing a lot of it, you're really leaning into it and you're taking deep dives big time.
Go big or go home.
Yeah, exactly. Given your relationship with God, what do you think 10 years or 20 years or 30 years down the road he would say to you?
That God would say to me?
Yeah.
I pray that he says, well done. That you leaned in and you did the hard work and I was right there along with you to help you. But well done, because that girl, the one that you met in 2020, that was the girl I created. And look at what we've been able to accomplish together in the years that followed. Look at the lives that were impacted because you were willing to take the step to do the hard work and share your story, because maybe there's somebody who's just waiting for that story to ignite something in them. You know, I pray that I'm able to turn around and look at all those years and go, wow, I could have stayed silent, but I didn't. And because I didn't, God used it to do this.
That was Tori Sorge. Thank you, Tori, for coming on the podcast. You rock. I can't tell you how much I appreciated that conversation. And not a lot of mixed people that I meet know what it's like to grow up with a white family and be mixed. And I appreciated Tori for having this discussion and giving me space and allowing space for this discussion, because it's important. And it also talks about the impact that we all feel as people of color, because our whole lives have been centered around white people. And I'm not saying, well, white people are bad and shit like that. No. But if you look, it's centered around it. Beauty, culture, popular culture. I don't need to go on about that, you know. Anyways, please subscribe to the Multiracial White Boy Podcast. Okay, subscribe and please write a review of this podcast episode. I really enjoyed this one. I hope you did too, like I said. But please go out of your way. Go on iTunes, go on Spotify and write a review. Those reviews go a long way. Follow us on Instagram at Multiracial White Boy. Remember to do that. I'm always posting stuff about the podcast, and maybe you missed the podcast that I post about and you can listen to it. Thank you very much. Once again, I'm Kim Noonan, the host of Multiracial White Boy. I'll have a new episode in 2 weeks from today. So remember, new podcast episodes drop from now on every other Thursday. Have a great couple weeks. Take care. Bye-bye.